Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, comic satire by George Carlin. It's a speech to the National Press Club in 1999, and it still hits home today. I hope you'll stay tuned. If you've been a listener for a while, you've noticed that I am a fan of George Carlin in his later years, say, the two decades beginning around 1990. By then, Carlin had become a progressive political and social satirist, a staunch critic of the Pentagon, the Warhawks, the capitalist greedheads, and a critic of the narcissism of his fellow citizens. Today we'll hear a speech he gave during that period. However, this speech is not a hard-hitting Jeremiad. It's remarkably restrained. There's a complete absence of off-color words, and no individual politician is attacked by name. Well, Colin Powell is kidded a little for occasionally pretending to be black. Here, Carlin was not playing to a concert audience of fans. He had been invited to address the National Press Club, the prestigious Association of National Affairs Journalists in Washington, D.C. So I think Carlin was minding his manners more than usual. Most of all, his speech is an interesting and often funny complaint on the abuse of language. First, the language of politicians, then Americans' general love of euphemisms, and last, the language of political correctness. Alas, he passes up the chance to mock the god-awful language of the media themselves. Although the speech is restrained in tone, it is often funny, and it has a great deal well worth hearing. Return with us now to those fun-filled days of the Clinton administration, the 13th of May, 1999, the day after Carlin's 62nd birthday. Here he is, addressing the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Let's snip out the introductory chit-chat and pick up where Carlin gets down to business.
Now, having somewhat successfully established my press credentials, and because you and I have at least one thing in common, which is that all of us deal with language all the time, I thought it might be nice today for me to come to you with some of my language complaints. Certainly not to blame them on you, although, of course, you are implicated. And not that you can help it. I mean, the problem is really with the people you cover. The politicians, the celebrities, and the lawyers. And although their level of insincerity is astonishing, it's still kind of fun to hear them talk. In particular, it's fun to listen to Washington talk. Whenever the issue of term limits comes up, I always tell people the only term limits I'm interested in would be to limit some of the terms used by politicians. They speak, of course, with great caution because they must take care not to actually say anything. Proof of this, according to their own words, is that they don't actually say things, they indicate them. As I indicated yesterday, and as the president indicated to me, but sometimes they don't indicate, they suggest. Let me suggest that as I indicated yesterday, I haven't determined that yet. See, they don't decide, they determine. If it's a really serious matter, they make a judgment. I haven't made a judgment on that yet. When the hearings are concluded, I will make a judgment, or I might make an assessment. I'm not sure. I haven't determined that yet. But when I do, I will advise you. They don't tell, they advise. I advised him that I had made a judgment. Thus far, he hasn't responded. They don't answer, they respond. He hasn't responded to my initiative. An initiative is an idea that isn't going anywhere. When he responds to my initiative, I will review his response, take a position, and make a recommendation. See, they don't read, they review, they don't have opinions, they take positions, and they don't give advice, they make recommendations. And so, at long last, after each has responded to the other's initiatives, and each has reviewed the other's responses, and everyone has taken a position, made a judgment, and offered a recommendation, now they have to do something. But that would be much too direct. So instead, they address the problem. We're addressing the problem, and we'll soon be proceeding. That's a big activity here in Washington. Proceeding. They're always proceeding or moving forward. A lot of that goes on. Senator, have you solved that problem? Well, we're moving forward on that. And when they're not moving forward, they're moving something else forward, such as the process. We have to move the process forward so we can implement the provisions of the initiative in order to meet these challenges. No one has problems anymore. Challenges. That's why we need people who can make the tough decisions. Tough decisions like how much soft money can I expect to collect in exchange for my core values? So that... so that I can continue my work in government. Of course, no politician would admit to such a lowly station as working in government, serving the nation. I'm serving the nation. Another favorite distortion is public service. I'm in public service. I like America, don't you? The food is great, but the public service is terrible. Now, folks, a question for you. Do you think it's possible that one of these politicians, whose judgment is so poor that he honestly thinks of himself as serving the nation, might occasionally be expected to indulge in a little patriotism? Huh? What do you think? Well, of course, not only is it possible, it's inevitable, and that's when he's at his very best. That's when he trots out the really good stuff all across this great land of ours, the greatest nation on earth, the greatest nation in the history of the world. And in times of military crisis, you can be sure that someone in a suit in this town will eventually plant himself in front of a camera and carry on a great deal about the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. Now, normally, during peacetime, the politicians will refer to people in the military as our young men and women stationed around the world. But in wartime, they quickly become our brave young fighting men and women stationed halfway around the world in places whose names they can't pronounce, wondering if they'll ever see their loved ones again. For added emotional impact, sons and daughters can always be substituted for men and women. And so I think we can sum this up by saying that where the military is concerned, the extent of a politician's insincerity can be measured by how far around the world our soldiers are stationed and whether or not any of them can pronounce it. Incidentally, another way of expressing this sentiment is to say we're sending our young men and women to places the average American can't find on a map. I've always thought it was kind of funny and somewhat out of character for a politician to go out of his way to point out the low level of American intelligence when indeed his very job depends upon it. It would seem to fly in the face of that other rhetorical standby of theirs, the American people are a lot smarter than they're given credit for. This is said with a straight face, although it is obvious, of course, that the proposition is being stated precisely backwards. But the politicians, God bless them, or something like that, they're at their most entertaining when they're in trouble. When they're in trouble, their explanations usually begin simply with words like miscommunication. What did you do wrong, Senator? Well, it was a miscommunication. Or I was quoted out of context. Better yet, and more ironic, they twisted my words. Such a nice touch. A person who routinely spends his days torturing the language complains, they twisted my words. Then, as the controversy continues to heat up, he moves to his next level of complaint. The whole thing has been blown out of proportion. It's always the whole thing. Apparently, no one has ever claimed that only a small portion of something was blown out of proportion. Has to be the whole thing. That's because now he's feeling the heat. And so, as time passes and more evidence comes in, he suddenly changes directions and tells us, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. Now he's on the side of law and order. It's jiu-jitsu, really. We're trying to get to the bottom of this so we can get the facts out to the American people. That's always a nice touch, American people. In fact, at this point, he might even say, I'm willing to trust in the fairness of the American people. Clearly, he's preparing us for something. And so, when finally all the facts come out and our subject seems quite guilty, he employs that sublime use of the passive voice, mistakes were made. Mistakes were made, don't look at me. Probably someone in my office. Things are moving faster now. Mistakes were made is rapidly overtaken by there is no evidence. No one has proven anything. Eventually, I will be exonerated. I have faith in the American judicial system. And that certain sign that things are closing in, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Whatever happened? Well, nah, yeah. Well, he's about to find out. And we know this must be true because the next thing we hear from him is, I just want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. I just want to put this behind me. That's an expression we hear a lot these days in all walks of life. From people in all walks of life, usually the person in question has committed some unspeakable act. Yes, it's true, I strangled my wife, shot the triplets, set fire to the house, and sold my young son to an old man on the train. But now I just want to put this thing behind me. Get on with me. That's the problem in this country. Too many people are getting on with their lives. I think what we really need more of is ritual suicide. You know? Never mind the press conferences. Get the big knife out of the drawer. Personally, what I want to do is to put this, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life, thing behind me and get on with my life. I'll repeat that for you. Personally, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life, thing behind me and get on with my life. And just to round out this section, let's hope there's a special place in hell reserved for those who have recently decided to take responsibility for their actions. That's the big thing now, taking responsibility for your actions, like it's a recent discovery, you know. He's taking responsibility for his actions. Well, isn't that wonderful? Ask him if he's willing to take responsibility for my actions, along with my alimony, my car payments, and my gambling debts. Now, continuing with more of these more general language complaints, and forgetting the Washington angle for the moment, I'd like to mention America's love affair with euphemisms and euphemistic language. I think Americans have some difficulty dealing with reality and have invented a kind of soft language to protect themselves. And this tendency to euphemize, if that's a verb, increases, it seems, with every generation. Here's an example. There's a well-known condition in combat when a fighting man's nervous system has been stressed to the breaking point and he's either snapped or is ready to snap. In the First World War, that condition was known as shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language, two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was over 80 years ago. Then an entire generation passed, and in the Second World War, the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now, takes a little longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had Korea, 1950, Madison Avenue was riding high, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. We're up to eight syllables now, and the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's absolutely sterile, operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Finally, of course, there was Vietnam, and given the lies surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen, and the pain is now completely buried under jargon, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd be willing to bet that if we'd still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time they needed it. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons, I'm sure, is because of that soft language, the language that takes the life out of life. And it does keep getting worse over time. I'll give you a few more, but less dramatic examples. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I was not consulted on this. It just happened. Sneakers became running shoes. Loafers became slip-ons. Motels became motor lodges. Trailers became mobile homes. Truck stops became travel plazas. And used cars became previously owned transportation. Manicurists evolved into nail technicians. At about the same time, store clerks became product specialists and sales associates. Employees became staff. Uniforms became career apparel. Maids became room attendants, and room service became guest room dining. Information turned into directory assistance. Medicine turned into medication. The dump turned into the landfill. Gambling joints turned into gaming resorts. Shacking up, living together, reruns, encores. Encore presentations, forgive me. Monkey bars, pipe frame exercise units. Wife beating became intermittent explosive disorder. And constipation became occasional irregularity. Rainforests and wetlands came into existence because the environmentalists discovered people were not willing to give money to save jungles and swamps. And... now, all of this happened in the last 30 years. When I was a young man, if someone got sick, they went to the hospital or they went to the doctor. Now, the health maintenance organization sends them to a wellness center where they consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now, the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And we can't really discuss euphemisms if we don't mention that final taboo, death. Used to be that when an old person died, the undertaker put him in a coffin and we sent flowers to the funeral home where they held a wake. Then after the funeral, they drove the dead person in a hearse to the cemetery and his body was buried in a grave. Now, when a senior citizen passes away, the mortician places him in a burial container and we send floral tributes to the slumber room where the grief coordinator supervises the viewing. After the memorial service, the funeral coach transports the departed to the Garden of Remembrance, where his remains are interred in his final resting place. Some of this language can make you want to throw up. Well, perhaps engage in an involuntary protein spill. Now, if all of this begins to put you in mind of so-called politically correct language, or politically correct speech, excuse me, then you and I are on the same track. So let's visit that playground of guilty white liberals, the land of the politically correct. In recent years, the PC folks have found some new ways of shading the truth in order to make people feel better, especially minorities. One of the newer phrases making the rounds is happens to be. He happens to be black. I have a friend who happens to be black.
Oh, I see, yes, yes.
Like it's an accident, you know. Happens to be black. Yes, he happens to be black.
I see, I see, I see.
He had two black parents? Yes, that's right, two black parents. Yes.
I see. I see. And they had sex? Oh, indeed they did. Yeah, I see.
So where does the surprise part come in? I should think it would be more unusual if he just happened to be Scandinavian. Another favorite term is openly gay. I have a friend who's openly gay. But that's the only minority they use that for. You know, you wouldn't say someone was openly black. Well, maybe James Brown. Yes. James Brown, yes. Or Louis Farrakhan. Louis Farrakhan is openly black. Colin Powell is not openly black. Colin Powell is openly white. He just happens to be black. And while we're at it, when did the word urban become synonymous with the word black? Did I sleep through this, perhaps? Urban styles, urban trends, urban music. I was not consulted on this at all again. Didn't get an email, didn't get a fax, didn't get a postcard. That's fine, let them go. So, I would like to tell you how I handle some of these speech issues concerning minorities. First of all, I say black. I say black because most black people prefer black. I don't say people of color because it's dishonest. It means precisely the same thing as colored people, which is an insult. So if you're not willing to say colored people, you shouldn't be willing to say people of color. And besides, to me, the whole idea of color seems a bit specious, really. I mean, what should we call white people? People of no color? Isn't pink a color? And in fact, white people are not really white at all. They're different shades of pink and olive and beige. In other words, they're colored. And black people are rarely black. I see mostly various shades of brown and tan, and in fact, some light-skinned black people are darker than the darkest white people. I'm sorry, lighter than the darkest white people. Look how dark the people in India are. They're dark brown, but they're considered white. May I see the color chart, please? People of color is an awkward phrase that obscures meaning rather than enhancing it. What shall we call fat people? People of size? I also don't say African Americans. I find it cumbersome and confusing. Which part of Africa are we talking about? Egypt? Egypt is in Africa, but Egyptians aren't black. They're like the people in India. They're dark brown white people, but they're Africans. So why wouldn't an Egyptian citizen who becomes an Egyptian who becomes a U.S. citizen be called an African American? The same would apply to South Africa. Suppose a white racist from South Africa becomes an American citizen. Couldn't he call himself an African American? If for no other reason than just to bother black people. And what about a black person born in South Africa who becomes an American citizen? Is he an African American or is he a South African American? Or is he simply a South African American African American? You know, it's just so much more tedious liberal labeling. Liberals should be taught that labels divide people, and I think we could probably do with fewer labels, not more. Now, one more group, the Indians. I call them Indians because that's what they are. They're the Indians. There's nothing wrong with the word. First of all, it's important to know that Indian, that word, probably does not derive from Columbus believing he had reached India in 1492. India was called Hindustan. More likely, the word derives from Columbus's description of the people he found here. He was an Italian who spoke very poor Spanish, and in his written accounts, he called the Indians una gente in Dios, a people in God. In God, in Dios, Indians. It's a perfectly noble thing. And I simply can't justify this awkward phrase, Native Americans. First of all, they're not natives. They came here from Asia over the Bering Land Bridge. In fact, there are no natives anywhere in the world. Everyone is from somewhere else. All people are refugees, immigrants, or aliens. If there are natives anywhere, it would have to be people still living in the Great Rift Valley in Africa. So everyone is just visiting. So much for native. As far as calling them Americans is concerned, well, how can I say this? We steal their hemisphere, destroy 500 cultures, kill 20 million, stick the rest of them on the worst land we can find, and then as a special bonus, we name them after ourselves. Come on. It's embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. The truth is, most Indians are insulted by the term Native American. The American Indian movement will tell you that. If you wish to please Indians, try calling them by their traditional names, Pawnee, Mohawk, Navajo, Seminole, and so on. Now, Just rounding out this theme and to make you a little more uncomfortable, here are a few further examples of tortured modern language designed to soften reality, make people feel good, and in general, dress things up a little. Somewhere over the years, the word cripple has been lost. We don't have cripples anymore. Turns out we never did. All this time, they were physically challenged. It's an attempt to make people feel better. Physically challenged. And how's this one? Differently abled. And if you insist on using differently abled, then you must include all of us. We're all differently abled. Each of us can do things the other can't. Differently abled. The word crippled is not a dishonorable word. There's no shame in it. Jesus healed the cripples. He didn't engage in rehabilitative strategies for the physically disadvantaged. And we have then this continuing problem with the word fat. I use that term because that's what fat people are. They're fat. That's why we call them fat people. They're not large, they're not stout, they're not chunky, hefty, or plump, and they're not big-boned. Dinosaurs are big-boned. And they're not necessarily obese. Obese is a medical term. And they're not overweight. Overweight implies there is some correct weight. There is no correct weight. Heavy is also a misleading term. An aircraft carrier is heavy. It's not fat. Only people are fat, and that's what fat people are. They're fat. They're not exempt. They're not, for example, gravitationally disadvantaged. I offer no apology for this, by the way. It's not intended as criticism or insult. It's simply descriptive language. I'm not comfortable with euphemisms. I prefer seeing things the way they are, not the way some people wish they were. Midgets and dwarfs are midgets and dwarfs. They're not little people. Infants are little people. Leprechauns are little people. Midgets and dwarfs are midgets and dwarfs. They don't get any taller by calling them little people. I wish their lives were different. I wish they didn't have to walk around staring at crotches all day. But I cannot fix that, and I'm not going to lie about what they are. There are some people who playfully refer to them as vertically challenged. They're not vertically challenged. The flying Walendas were vertically challenged. The people who built the Empire State Building were vertically challenged. No shame in midgets and dwarves. I do have a closing. I realize my time is a little longer than I expected. May I do this closing poem? This, thank you, Larry. This is Try Stopping Me. Now... Thank you. This is just a poem I've written recently. It's called I'm a Man for the Millennium, and it tries to celebrate some of the language we hear all around us. I'm going to use my papers on this, although it'd be good if you kept rolling for me anyway. I'm a man for the millennium. I'm digital and smoke-free. I've been inputted, outsourced, uplinked, and downloaded. I have software on my hard drive, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm factory authorized, returnable, fully equipped, built to last, and I'm definitely biodegradable. My output is down, but my income is up. I'm tanned, rested, and market-tested, user-friendly, and lactose intolerant. A diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist. I'm a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, high-concept rageaholic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers, a bottom feeder and a top gun, a Bigfoot rainmaker. I give soft money with hard cash, and my revenue stream has a cash flow of its own. I'm ahead of the curve, riding the wave and pushing the envelope. I'm on board, on point, on message, but off drugs. I take power naps. I take victory laps. I've got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, and a personal agenda. I'm a totally ongoing slam dunk no-brainer with an outreach that's proactive. I eat junk food, I get junk mail, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I've been dumbed down with smart bombs. I'm in denial, I'm in recovery, but I'm out of the loop. I'm also on the bubble. A high-tech lowlife, anatomically, ecologically, and politically incorrect. An entry-level man with no exit strategy. Low rent, but high maintenance. Upscale, but down home. I got a minivan with a microwave from a megastore in the mini mall. I've been to outer space. I've been to outer space on the internet. I'm a non-believer and an overachiever, emotionally deprived and market-oriented. I have hardcore software because I use the F word in my email. I'm new wave from the old school, and if I'm not at ground zero, you can reach me at square one. I'm gender-specific, voice-activated, capital-intensive, heat-seeking, faith-based, and work-related, but I'm definitely not group-oriented. I'm online, I'm in line, but most of the time, I'm out of line. I'm cocked, locked, and ready to rock, rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I put the pedal to the metal, party hardy, and to me, lunchtime is crunch time. Thank you.
George Carlin, concluding his talk to the National Press Club on May 13, 1999. His theme, Abuses of Language and the Bad Effects Those Abuses Produce. If you are a Carlin fan, you can find a generous amount of his stuff on our previous broadcasts. These are available for the taking at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you will tune in again next week. Till then.